Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
All get up, look around. You see the dragon? You see the fucking dragon?
Yeah!
Dragon, die! Well, fucking breathe for you!
Yeah!
Yeah! Are we ready?
Yeah!
Are we ready? Yeah!
The great Scott Quinnell. Have you seen the fucking dragon? I have a couple of times, Scott. I have a couple of times. But on this episode, I'm joined by one of the best in the business. He was one of the best on the pitch. He's now one of the best off the pitch. A man who captained Wales and the British and Irish Lions, just to name a couple of his achievements. It's the wonderful Sam Warburton.
Sam Warburton has been absolutely immense in this game.
We talked through my Olympic rowing times. I basically talked myself up for about 2 minutes to one of the fittest and strongest who have ever done it. I asked the question whether or not he retired prematurely. We go through the violence and the physicality needed to play rugby at the highest level.
What a tackle by Sam Warburton! What a tackle!
And some of the most ferocious rugby games that we've seen in the last 12 months. So settle back, enjoy, make sure you're subscribed on Spotify, on YouTube, on all the wonderful platforms. Leave a review, hit the follow button, and keep the algorithm flying. I don't even know what that means, but keep it going. But thank you everyone for your support. Peel back and enjoy.
This is the Big Jim Show.
All get up, look around. You see the dragon? You see the fucking dragon?
Yeah!
Dragon, die! Well, fucking breathe for you.
Yes!
Are we ready?
Yes!
Are we ready?
Wales got lots of problems to solve. Wales got lots of issues of old. Please, Mr. Warby, tell me how we can save Welsh rugby for now.
All get up, look around. You see the dragon? You see the fucking dragon?
Warby, how are you? So cool that you've got a good setup there. It's a rarity, even when we record the pod.
Do you know what? It was COVID it was, because COVID, everything jumped online, didn't it? So I thought, and I was doing an hour about getting a home office done. So there's like a guy, my mate uses, like, oh, mate, if you're going to get internet done, he needs to order your cable in, he's like, shit off. So I got like a special cable put in, I got it all routed into the computer. So if I need to do this, I can just do it click of a fingers, really. So has to get, where's yours, Jim? You in the studio, you at home? Or?
Yeah, I'm at home. Yeah, so we've got the studio in London, but like, as we've come to realise, because it's Spotify, it's quite limited in terms of studio time, obviously. Getting guys like yourself over from Wales, time's not...
It does look good, mind. It looks good when you're in a suit. And you do... It is nice to be face-to-face, maybe one day. But, sorry.
No, mate, not at all. No, it is. Like, that's part of it, isn't it? But I think with the industry that we're in, with the travel, with the kids and stuff like that, and the fact that... Well, the set similar to you, like probably more comfortable going back and forth. And we've got microphones, so you can overtalk me, I can overtalk you, and we can have more of a conversation. But when it's done remote, sometimes, and you don't have this set up, it's
I know. Well, no, thanks for asking. It's good to go on, mate. I think you've done a wicked job with the pod anyway, so it's nice to be on, mate.
Yeah, thanks, mate. Look, I found, and again, this is something I talk about on the podcast and stuff like that as well, Warby, that I've kind of found my lane and niche. Yes, I would like to be doing a bit more mainstream, of course. Like,
you're very natural at it.
Before we get into the mainstream media stuff, Warby, how's training first and foremost? You're looking well.
Mate, I don't know. Rugby players go one way or another. It's like people say to me, oh, you're still training then? I'm like, old habits die hard. But then some ex-pros then go the other way and they just go full derby, pizza, beers, no exercise. You kind of go, you take two routes and you finish playing, don't you? And my mum would always be like, oh, wait till you get to my age, you'll be like, you'll start putting on weight. I'm like, never, mum, never. She's like, wait till you get older. I'm like, no, No, I'm going to be that like berserk 70-year-old still trying to lift in. And people go, fair play, look at that 70-year-old dude trying to bicep curl over there. That'll be me, mate. So I can't help myself, you know. What's your routine like at the minute? You in a good one?
Yeah, I love training. And maybe that perception wasn't there as a player. I was always into fitness. So I love the watt bike. I love the rowing machine. I did long distance running, albeit very slow. But that was kind of my point of difference, was I had a big old engine. So I'm kind of going down that route still now.
I heard you were mental good on the rower. I had a coach who used to coach you. And he said back in the day at Leicester, he said it was you, Martin Johnson and someone
Martin
else,
Corrie.
Yeah, and they said you guys just used to go head to head on the rower, and he's like, you never see numbers like it. He's like, you boys could pull that thing like crazy, you know. So when you said you got an engine, I was like, yeah, that's transcended into Wales about your engine on the rower. So
I'll take that. You're built for rowing, but on that, so when we were leading up to the World Cup in 2011. So Richie Gray, did you tour Richie Gray in 2013?
Yeah,
you would have seen he's a freak athlete. So me and him did sub 6 minute 2Ks, which is Olympic time. So I did a 5:58 and I was fucked. Like, as in, that was me completely maxed out. He did like a 5:52 and had more in him. Like, as in, that would have put him in the top five in Scotland, I think, as in history to have done it.
Sure, so I'm going to write this down. Because I got to challenge some people to that, because it's funny because they're getting nowhere near it. Well, 2K, hang on. 2 kilometre time trial, basically. And under
anything
6 is good.
Under 6 minutes is, I think that is like Olympian time. Like, that would put you in the top 50 in the world or top 100 in the world or something ridiculous.
I might do that for a laugh. I'll be about 8 minutes or something like that.
I love the fact that I'm talking about training with you, but as in a watt bike, I've got a watt bike in the garage. And that there, you know, with stuff like that will be, and you'll be the same because you retired young or perceived to be young and probably still strong and in decent shape. The watt bike for me is a go-to because my numbers and the output are strong. So that gives me energy because it's quite soulless, isn't it? Being on your own on a watt bike in the garage. But I compare times like Ebenezerbeth, me and him go back and forth and I'm nowhere near him on the short stuff.
Is it?
He's a freak.
I want to write these down as well. We haven't lost that competitive nature at all. What sort of numbers are you chucking around on the watt bike?
So 1Ks. So if you do a cluster of 1K sprints, so if you do 1K with, it's meant to be a one-to-one, but do a 1K with a 1 minute 30 rest after each one, I'll do them all under 110.
Jesus.
Around
1, I know that's 8, quick.
1.9. And I think Eben's around 106. When we're talking 105, 106.
I'll be honest now, I'm not an engine guy. I'm much more of a strength and power guy. So engine was the last thing that would come with me. That was my worst thing in training. Tipperick used to absolutely spank me. But he was the best thing that happened because he would blitz me in fitness. It would make me work really hard on my fitness. Then it was probably vice versa. He'd probably look at me from a strength and power perspective, then he had to up his strength and power. So that's why when you talk about competition, the press think, oh, you're just trying to make out that you're friends. Like, no, competition is, you need it. I was on at home, I got a Concept 2, so I'm not sure that's a bit different, the static bike. To show how bad I am compared to you, I'll try and do a 10K and I'll try and keep up like 1 minute 50 kilometers. And then I am blowing doing that. So you're way quicker than me on those. Fair play to you. I am not much of an engine guy.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. So I stick with the engine, but then I am big on weights as well. And I weren't big on weights as a player because the body was wrecked, but I know the importance now of being a 41-year-old, 6'9" human being and the bone density, but also like aesthetically, right? You know, old tall people don't age well. Like, they just don't. Like, it's a fact. So
I love all this. And like, you know, people go on podcasts and they throw out crazy false claims, which I make sure I'd never be that person. But I was listening to somebody who's way more credible than me. And I listen to these guys because they'll just like, they combine real life experience with the meta-analysis, peer-reviewed studies. None of this, oh, this was done on 20 rats in like Serbia or some rubbish. Like, this is proper, like, you're talking big population pools, cross-section of studies. And they're saying the two longest, or the two most closely linked indicators to life expectancy is strength and VO2 max. So when we say strength, we're not talking powerlifting, we're just talking, just having a reasonable level of physical strength and how fit you are. So that's why when people are on about exercise as medicine, it's like, no, literally, exercise is medicine, which is why I'm not really, I don't enjoy going on the bike, but I do it. People go, what motivates you now? And I'm like, well, why do you train? I'm like, for life. I want my kids to be able to have a dad when I'm in my 80s, hopefully, or 90s. I'm training to be fit for life and to live long, you know. So, yeah, aesthetics is obviously a lovely byproduct of that.
Yeah, but with the kids as well, Warby, and this is something that I've noticed, the missus into training as well. Like she's used to be an athlete and she does the high rock stuff and the CrossFit stuff now, but we've got nice. Four children. And
four?
We got four. I know, we had twins last
Fair
round.
Play too.
Yeah, by accident. They weren't on accident. It was on purpose. I love you. So we've went 2 to 4, right? But as in the same, like we're healthy at home, like we eat healthy. And it's hard. Like people say, oh, it's easy to eat healthy. Like it's easier to go and get a bowl of cereal, right? Which is the worst thing that you can have. But I've got a real bugbear with schools and with society, how everything is around English, maths and science still at school and sitting down, exams, being quiet. And I've got two boys within that mix, two boys, two girls. Whereas as you're aware, I'm aware, and you look at society and you look at the shift, like Scotland's got the highest obesity rate in the whole of Europe. Health, nutrition are the number one factors for any human being. Yet it is the least spoken about and the least done.
So true.
As kids coming through, I just think it's mental. I know we are segueing and we will get onto a little bit of ruggers.
But yeah, sorry, that's my fault because I'm so obsessed on all
exactly.
that.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm obsessed with it, but I know that you're big into that training, obviously the academy stuff that you do, but it's everything. I think like athleticism, the way that you move, your nutrition, gut health is linked to brain health and all of these different things. It's mental that people don't talk about it more at schools and with our children.
And like what I don't like is like people will look at packets and it'll be like percentage of RDA, which means recommended daily allowance. Now, if I imagine some people don't look at most of their food packets, but all those recommendations aren't very accurate, particularly like protein intake. Protein intake needs to be a lot higher. And that's why like I like try and encourage my grandparents, they're not around anymore, but I'd be like, eat more protein. They'd be like, why? I'm like, well, as you get older, you naturally eat less protein, probably because you lose your teeth, you're not willing to chew on meat and things like that, because that typically comes from animal sources. They lose muscle mass, they fall over, and the first fall is the beginning of the end.
Yeah, 1,000,000%. I even doubled down further. I got an ice bath, not just because Rogan and all these guys are into it, but I got an ice bath and a sauna at home as well.
And I've heard sauna big benefits as well, yeah.
Swear by it. You have to find your own way to do it. So I tried the morning routine of going in the ice bath for 3 minutes and getting out of the ice bath and doing 100 press-ups on my knees, 100 sit-ups and 100 bodyweight squats, but I didn't enjoy it. So now I do like a half an hour sauna every night and I'll do a minute and a half in the ice bath. And I always slept well anyway, but genuinely, it's almost like, and I'm not addicted. I've not got an addictive personality to anything, but I feel like I'm addicted to that kind of feeling that it gives me after. So big investment, but yeah, it's great.
I tried the ice bath stuff in this morning routine thing because, and it's a load of rubbish, isn't it? Social media, a lot of it. I saw this one like clip which went viral and it was like, the morning routine for all successful people, if you want to be successful. And like, I bet these 15-year-olds are watching this going, this is gospel. And it's like, wake up, 20 minutes of yoga, then it's like 10 minutes of reflection, then it's like electrolyte drink, and then it's like cold plunge, then it's like goal set for the day. I was like, mate, my morning routine is get up, wipe my 3-year-old's ass, get down, dog runs out in the garden, chases squirrels, get back, make a bottle of milk, tidy up the Nesquik that's been thrown around the kitchen. I'm like,
that's my reality. Morning.
Yeah, and I don't listen to that rubbish, do you know what I mean? So, yeah, I agree with you, mate. It's cold and hot stuff is good. I do it, but like I said, I tried it in the morning routines. I just got to fit it in the day when I can because, you know, it's like life with kids. Kids come first, everything else comes second, doesn't it?
Yeah, and we're well placed to talk about this, Warby. I don't think it's about preaching. And like when you look at what other athletes or ex-athletes are doing when they retire, we're like the perfect example, I suppose, of putting your body through the mill, both physically and mentally, the head as well, everything that goes with that. And then coming out of that, I mean, what age did you retire? You were bloody young, weren't you? Were you in your 20s
my last
still?
Game, yeah, 20s. My last game was at 28. And I called it a day at 29. I know. I look back, I look at 28-year-olds now, I'm like, That's like Ben Hill retiring in 2 years. I'm like, it must have felt so. I didn't think it at the time because it felt like I was doing it flipping ages because I found it hard. But I was like, now I'm out of it. It was quite premature compared to other players. How old are you?
I was 34. And if I was a dog, they would have put me down a couple of years before. Yeah, genuinely. Man, I was absolutely fine. I had a 2-year deal at London Irish. Like a great deal.
What's it?
Like, I think it was 200 odd grand a year for 2 years, like each
year.
At 34 plus a testimonial. Yeah. And it was one of them, mate, where I had to make the decision and be like, you know what? mercy, I'm fucked. And we joke about it. I couldn't even. I was at Saracens with Will Skelton, so he was sat next to me. There you go. So you imagine, like, he's like double my size. I was fading away. I suppose the dark side of rugby, which was all on me, taking copious amounts of painkillers just to get through the day. Just in my mind, I was like, look, it's.
Yeah, a penny drop moment. My body shouldn't be going through this.
It started to feel off, and like, I've gone around the house on it. I had to have a thyroid operation to have that removed and stuff like that.
Was that recent? Because we were in the car that one time. Remember? Yeah. And you said you were scheduled that up. Yeah, that went all went down fine.
Yeah, all went down fine. But that was like, so after rugby, and that brings me back to the training and looking after yourself and your physical, mental health and all that. I mean, I was proper fucked, and that thyroid kind of blowing out was. Just caused a load of issues. So that's why I invested in all of these things and why I invested in myself.
I'm not laughing at you because you say you're fucked. I'm laughing because you actually take a bit of a bit of comfort in that you're not on your own. Do you know what I mean? We've all kind of gone through it.
And that's why I think we're so well placed. Like, we're young men, and this is a difficult period in time for men in general, isn't it? Like, as in you're a parent, you're a dad. The pressures of earning, of understanding where you are in the world. At the minute, there is a big suppression on men as well. But you're pieces of shit, and all these kind of wider societal things. There's a lot on men, there really is. And we're in that kind of, what I say to my mates when I see them stressed out, and they are struggling because they've got tough jobs, they're living on the breadline, they don't train, they don't have the ability, they feel they don't have time. And I just say, look, lads, it's tough. Like, it's tough for me, and I'm earning well, I train every day, like, I've got everything in place, I've got a great career, I've transitioned out of rugby, and it's still tough. So I think it's just making people aware that this is a tough moment in time between your mid-20s or 30, whenever you have kids, until you get through that kind of the stresses and the pressures of bringing children up, fucking tough.
My brother goes to it now, he lives like bang opposite me, and I'm just like, I kind of look at it as like, oh, you're in this, I don't know why, but I'm like, I'm in this, I feel like this accumulation phase of my life. I think probably a lot of 35-year-olds might be in it. It's like, you're paying off your mortgage, you're trying to build a career, you've got kids at the same time, trying to maintain some sort of social life as well. But I think, but you put in the time now into your kids and into your career now. Like, you'll be, but then like you'll wish then that you're 45 and in a slightly more comfortable position, looking back, a bit more time, all your kids are in full-time school, for example. But then I bet you every 45-year-old, or say 50, let's go a bit higher, a 56-year-old would be looking back and going, I wish I was in the carnage of being 35 again. Mm. But having 25 years of life ahead of me, and I go back to that chaos straight away. So I think it's all always perspective. There was one good quote I heard, someone was like, When you're 20, you wish you're a millionaire and you're 40. And when you're 40, you wish you were 20 with no money.
Warby, the BBC stuff, very, very good. Not just you personally, who I think you're one of the best in the business, but it feels like they've edged up a little bit and they've kind of maybe changed the dial on how they're doing things, how it looks. Cultural relevancy has been thrown about in loads of different forums about bringing rugby into this new age. It was a little bit unexpected, some of the stuff that you've come out with, which I agree, we're very aligned on a lot of the stuff, but I'm not saying that I didn't expect you to say it. It was more an expectation of like some of the words being used, like your column in the Times, like violence and kind of how open you are on BBC. Is that an intentional move that BBC and yourself and the Times have had, or is it just you being you?
I'll be honest, the producer at BBC, and he'll remain anonymous, because he hates having any... I'm like, mate, you're like the captain of our ship. You're the reason I think we have a great programme. Like, come on, when they did the Day in the Life of Sam Warburton, I wanted to get him in it. He's like, no camera. I don't want to be front-facing at all. But he's brilliant because he gives us the space to be us and to say the game as it is. And there were times from certain people, they'd be like, yeah, no, you can't use the word collision. You have to use the word big tackle. I was like, oh, come on. And I think what it is, like rugby, like, right, we don't celebrate the gladiatorial nature of rugby enough. And it's only at our level, when you play at that professional level, which is the top 0.01% of people, where the game can be slightly dangerous. I've always said, rugby, you can make it safer, you will never make it safe. Mate, I love watching UFC. I have absolutely no ambition to go in that octagon. I think you've got to be mental to go in there. Like, you're a different animal if you want to go in there and you know that one of you is going to be walking out probably KO'd. But I love watching it. And it's the same with rugby. We don't have to think that, like, oh, if we celebrate the gladiatorial nature of rugby, it's going to detract from the viewing. No, mate, there's a reason that amphitheatres used to be filled up thousands of years ago. I'm not saying we're going in with spears and things, right? But there's some, mate, people don't go, 75,000 people don't turn up in Cardiff to watch tag. They go in to watch rugby players confrontationally win a game of rugby. Like, there's something innate about our human nature from going back to tribes and one tribe beating another when England play Scotland or Wales play England. Like, we want to win. Like, we need to celebrate that more often. We're not saying everyone should be doing this, but we want to attract people to watch it and to make the game as popular as possible. And when I did my Times column, I did say, I was like, you're not going to like this, but this is just the terminology that I would use as a captain, that my coaches would use with me, and that we'd use as a group. And that word, violent. And look, when we're saying violent, we're not saying I want to intentionally injure someone and smash him in the head. Violent just means I'm going to physically dominate him within the laws of the game. And it would always be called like intelligent aggression. You know, we're not being dull. We're not saying you've got to stamp on people, but you've got to physically dominate within the rules. And that's what, now I played football when I was 14 years of age. I was a handy footballer, but I played for this one team, which had quite a good record, disciplinary record. And, my first season, I got 2 reds and 3 yellows. Not from foul play. I'm not a foul play guy. I've never liked foul play. But just from being physical and abrasive. And I remember at that age thinking, I need to play a sport where I'm legally allowed to hurt people. I'm not going to get punished for it. And that's when I fell in love with rugby. There would be someone on the other team who'd be giving it the big one. Man, I love that. And it's weird. I think you've got that mentality or not. You'd have it. You'd have to. You can't play in the front five international rugby without that. You have to have that mentality of, mate, I'm going to dominate you. Like, mate, I love that about rugby. Ironically, it's what finished me, the physicality side of it. But, mate, I played rugby for a reason. That's why I'd say I like this sort of opportunity and I love what you do. But you, and like people go, I did that column. I posted it on my social media. Someone's like, Sam, wrong choice of language. I'm like, I'm sorry, this is just what's spoken about. This is actually factual because I've been in there and I've done it hundreds of times.
Yeah.
I'm not saying this is what you need to do at grassroots. I'm just saying this is what happens at international level. Like it or not, this is what happens. So yeah, I like that they give us a little bit more flexibility at the Times and the BBC to actually discuss the game as it is so people see the truth. Of course, there's a fine line, but it's only dangerous, mate, at the very top 0.1. It's not even dangerous. It's only mildly... And the protocols are in place anyway, but it can only become a risk at the top level. But you've got to remember, these boys are very well conditioned, very well looked after medically. But I'm glad that I've always thought, as long as I can be honest and say it as it is, then you're doing the right things. So I try and just stick by that.
Yeah, that's amazing. Like, genuinely, Warby, it needs people like you, not people like me, because it can be like banging on the old drum. And the way that I played the game probably was over the line in terms of violence, probably a little bit dirty as well, because that's all I had. And that was where I was brought up. From in that kind of environment, that kind of,
but you need a bit of that. You do.
And I am drawn to them sports like UFC, like boxing, the gladiatorial sports like that. And the way I think about it, when you talk about the violence and when you talk about like certain individuals, and you have to be kind of built differently. And having Courtney Laws on the Rugby Pod talk about it, and that blew up. Yeah. Obviously, then the Times ran an article with that. Celebrating, not necessarily celebrating violence, but celebrating the chaos and celebrating rugby for what it is, and understanding the sell and where the commercial opportunity, where the growth lies. And they are uncomfortable conversations that I've been having, like, as in the game isn't for everyone. Like, it's Courtney said everyone can play the game, but it's not for everyone at the highest level. You have to be a special kind of athlete to do it. And that's more so than ever. Imagine Eben Etzebeth or Peter Steph de Toy playing volleyball. Like, they're wasted. You know what I mean?
Mate, I was at an event the other day, and this is why I love what Courtney said, because I've sort of said it and a few times, but not on the same platform as Courtney. And probably because I was cautious that it would be... And that's why when he did it, I noticed, I think you commented, I commented on it. A few people were like, brilliant, well done, Courtney. And I was at an event just before Courtney said this, and... I had a mother come up to me and said, oh, my son's playing. Can you give me some advice? He doesn't really like tackling and contact, but he likes playing rugby. Like, but I think he could be really good and I wanted to get to the top. What would your advice be? I said, do you want my honest advice or do you want my plastic advice? She went, go on then, give me honest advice. I said, he's probably not going to make it. Because to get to the top level, you have to have a certain mindset and appetite for the physical side of the game, or you're just going to give up. Mm-hmm. Like you've got to have that. And if you don't have it, I'm like, all right, you might be exceptionally skilled in attack, and you might make it to professional level, but I've seen a lot of fullbacks come through who are very attack-minded. They do great at 20s level, but I see their appetite in defence, and I go, he ain't going to play test match, because that'll just get called out straight away in training. You ain't good enough, mate, if you can't be good both sides of the ball. And that's why I love what Courtney said. Like, and look, we're not trying to encourage everyone to play it. At grassroots level, we'd love obviously loads of people to play it. But at top level, we're not saying, look, this is a game for everyone at top level. But we're saying this is a game that a lot of people can tune in and enjoy the spectacle and entertainment of rugby, because it's brilliant. And say like what you've gone through. That's why like I laugh about what you go through with your body. Like, people don't realise what... Like, I grew up watching certain UFC fighters training, because I just, and boxers, tricks. I loved the adversity and how tough training was and how hard the sport was. And man, I loved putting myself through that, weirdly. Like, I hated it, but I loved it at the same time. We don't show that side of rugby enough. We don't show how hard, mate, pre-season, like World Cup pre-season, like, my God. Like, people only have to say to me, Sam, Poland, 2011, I put my head in my hands. I'm like, oh, like, but if you like documented that and showed people what you go through, people would have a lot more respect for those players taking the pitch rather than just seeing a couple of social media images of them in Dubai. It's like, no, they put themselves through a lot. There was one guy I was in school with, and he went into sort of, he wanted to go into politics, and they were like, oh yeah, sportsman, rugby player is easy. I'd love to be a rugby player. I was like, mate, I'll give you 3 months in pre-season with me, and I guarantee you'll leave after 3-4 weeks, probably 3-4 days, once you see our training schedule and what we have to go through. And not just that, you know, it's the time away, the sacrifices. I'm like, don't make out it's easy. And I'm not saying there's a lot of people who can't do it. There's people outside the rugby world who could do it. But that's why I think we have big respect for the military and things like that. But like, don't make out it's easy, because it's not. But I don't think we showcase that enough. And I think people would respect rugby players a lot more once they see what they put themselves through to be able to perform at the elite level.
Yeah. And when I was pitch side, and again, the listeners, I've mentioned this loads, but I want to talk to you about it because you're better placed than me, especially where you were as well, obviously watching it. I don't know where you were. Were you there for the quarterfinals of the World Cup?
No, I was there for the semis and final. Didn't make it out for the quarters.
Same thing. Okay, so once we got to them quarters in Paris and the semis and the finals carried on, I was pitch side and I had never seen beautiful chaos and violence and speed and power. And I was like, even now I get goosebumps thinking about it, because we've been there and done it. You've done it at a higher level than me, and they're doing it at a higher level than we've done it now, because the game's come on so much. And I've taken so much kind of backlash, and this is from everyone, from owners of clubs, from commercial sponsors, from people at World Rugby when I've had conversations before, friends, people walking down the street, where I'm saying that rugby players are underpaid. And, oh, what do you mean? But this club's going under, this is happening, the game isn't commercially viable. And yet I say to them, I don't care. That I can't control the commerciality of the game. I can't control sponsors. I can't control how the narrative of our game is spoken about in public forums, in the media, to the wider audience. And I can't control younger grassroots kids playing rugby in schools and whether or not games are cancelled, they should be playing more games, etc. I said, what I can control is my tone of voice when I speak about it on a podcast. And more so than ever, I'm there for the quarterfinals and I'm looking round, and it was a gladiatorial feel. It was like Maximus Decimus Aurelius in the Colosseum. The energy, the floor was vibrating. Every seat was sold out. Every pub in Ireland was sold out. Every pub in New Zealand was sold out. In France, all the fan zones. In South Africa, mate. And I'm like, they're millionaire athletes that are doing that. As in, don't tell me that there's no money in the game. This stadium is sold out. Every corporate seat that is, what, 500 quid a ticket, 250 quid a ticket, is sold out. Every pub is sold out. Don't tell me that there isn't any money in the game. It's crazy. There might not be any money in the tiers below that, I understand, and that's a different conversation. But the output of what we're seeing there compared to other sports, they are million-pound athletes doing that.
Mate, this is why I think we need to celebrate it more. Like, mate, that... There was the very similar to the quarterfinals. Those quarterfinals were, which I loved. Mate, they were ferocious. There was the, remember the Ireland South Africa pool game? Oh my God. I was in the studio watching that with Roy Best and Brian O'Driscoll. After 5 minutes, we looked at each other and we were just like, mate, we're used to it. We've played Six Nations international games and we're used to high-level rugby matches with a lot of intensity. But I watched that and we looked at each other and we were like, I was like, holy shit, I've never seen that in my life before. And because that's ITV, and that would have been broadcast to however many million. You know, when we're doing club games, you might get a few hundred thousand watching. I remember thinking, there's probably about a million people watching rugby for the first time here. And they'll be watching going, oh my God, what is this sport? But like what you said, the risk that those players are, what they're doing on that stage is phenomenal. And I think it's like, mate, what else competes with that apart from obviously your other codes of rugby? But even the World Cup is such a massive thing. I agree with you. I think what those players are going through is amazing. And they're not celebrated enough, you know. So, what is such a good sport? And I think sometimes we're trying to protect it too much. I think as long as you get the message across, look, this is only at the top level. And you've got to remember, the very top level, these players aren't just being parachuted from a local parks pitch. People say, is it really nerve-wracking when you play them? Like, look, you get physically conditioned over years and years to get to that level. And you mentally prepare for that because you gradually go through the ranks. You don't just get like parachuted in from playing your Division 5 club team and suddenly you're in a World Cup final. Like, those guys have taken all the necessary steps to get there. So it makes it way safer than people think. They're meant to be there. Their bodies can cope with it. Of course, you're going to get accidents and they're very few and far between. But I think the messaging around rugby is like, yeah, look, it's such an amazing high-octane gladiatorial sport, which I don't think you get many spectacles around the sporting world like it. I just think we need to celebrate that way more.
Yeah, and that's why I'm glad that guys like you are doing BBC, like you, Barkley, Ugo, the way that it's spoken about the game, as in the high energy. And I don't expect you to talk about this, but we were talking about it at home with a couple of mates and I was watching it and I mentioned it on the rugby pod as well. I'm watching the ITV game at the weekend, so the Scotland-Ireland game or Ireland-Scotland game, and the Six Nations is on the line. The Triple Crown is on the line. There's 2 minutes to go. And there's no energy. There's no energy in comms. There's no energy on the pitch. The ref's coming in to talk about the bunker, how it's not going to be a red card. I'm like, there's 2 minutes left in this game. Like, this is going down to the fucking wire. Like, there needs to be more hysteria. It needs to be like, to really, really sell it. Because on the pitch it is. That's what the players are feeling. And I just think we need to do more. And we need to really accelerate our storytelling, our narrative, and getting the very best people in them positions to sell our game. Because it feels like there is a bit of a desperation. Like you see in Netflix and how that was kind of marketed. And you could see the desperation from the Six Nations sharing all the content. This kind of mass collaboration came all at once, which was a desperate move. I completely understand that. As opposed to like an authentic rise of collaboration. But that's good that we are collaborating. We're doing more for sure.
What was your thoughts on the Netflix documentary? Have you seen it?
6 out of 10.
Yeah, I agree. I think I was chatting to some people about this and they were like, oh yeah, it was really good. But I think if you're involved in rugby, you could tell where it got dramatised. Commentary was redone, wasn't the original commentary. And I thought, I would much rather have seen, maybe it's because I've maybe seen some of the Hard Knock stuff growing up on the NFL. I would much, but I know it's all to do with access, but I would much rather see more team meetings, more training regimes. The in-game footage is good, but like changing room shots. I know there's certain access and I wonder whether there could be like some sort of control from the unions, like that can go out that car and they can pre-approve things. But I think to give more of that access, I don't think like watching a player drink coffee with his wife talk about the game, to be honest, doesn't excite me.
Right.
But I'd much rather watch a driving mall session on a Tuesday morning just after team selection and people can see the bite that those sessions have and how disappointed some players are that they're not selected versus the ones who are playing and the anxiousness they have prepping for a game. I'm like, that's a session I want to watch or that I think we should show, you know? So yeah, I agree with you, 6 out of 10. There's still a lot of stuff we could show to sell it better, I think.
Oh, 1,000,000%. And I'm the same. Look, I started this 8 years ago, Warby. So I did a documentary on the Bar Bars behind the scenes. I've done Leicester Tigers Academy. And it all stemmed from watching Hard Knocks when I was young on the Arcos and looking at what other sports were doing. I love NFL, yet I hardly watch the game. Right? I watch everything around it. I'm one of those that glitz and the glamour. You know, the boxing, the 20 for 20 that they used to show on ESPN, I think it was called, and the embedded in UFC. They're normally better. The build-up, UFC is a bit different. They're all generally pretty good fights, but the boxing build-up is generally better than the output the pitch. And like, you know, I'm speaking to the converted, like you see it the same way as me. And I just felt, yes, we missed a trick for bringing Netflix in. We're lucky that they've commissioned a second series. I'm hearing that there's more access, but we need to move away from this nicey stuff. Get the fucking cameras in the middle of the scrums, like you said, in the middle of the malls. You've got some of the biggest human athletes on the planet. The swearing, the jeopardy, the fights, the drama. And this is the thing, Wolby. In our sport, it seems like we don't embrace the drama. As in, that the stuff that was happening around Wales with the players going on strike, that's what Formula One would have shown all of that. Football would have shown all of that. That's what people want to see. Like, well, how can you go from that drama, Wolby? How can you have that drama and then go and play a test match at the weekend? Like, who's controlling that? Who's speaking?
I can only talk about my personal experiences. I'm not trying to make out this happened to just me, because this would happen to a lot of rugby players. And again, hopefully this won't put people off the game, but it would make brilliant watching. And like, and let's be honest, like I said, 99.9% of people aren't going to reach that level, so don't worry about it. But there was like a game I played in South Africa. But like I think showing this footage would be amazing. Like, I had a big hit after about 28 seconds. Went into a tackle, massive hit. Remember, I like put my finger on my mouth. Finger was covered in blood, but I could feel all my teeth, you know. I was like, oh, this is weird. But anyway, I played the full game. Couldn't speak at the end of the game. Went and spoke to the doctor. He grabbed, like, imagine cameras are on this now. They can replay this by showing the hit, showing you carry on play. He put his thumb somewhere on my jaw, made my knees hit the deck. I just dropped. He went, right, A&E straight away. Went to A&E, should show the x-ray. Yeah, mate, you've fractured your jaw. And then, you know, show the operation, plate in your jaw. Like, this is against South Africa. I'm like, I don't know. But like, you watch that, I'd be like, mate, that would be watching a player go through all that, watching the scans, watching the x-ray, watching the medical treatment, watching the on-field hit, watching them play on. And then you go, fair play.
People then understand. You know? People then get it. And they'll understand what we are talking about. And that will be there soon. You know, like that will be there soon. You look at the World Cup when Bongi Mbonambi goes off, and that needs to be followed. Like, he's off to hospital. Yeah. He gets taken to hospital. He gets scanned. What's he done? He's fucked everything in his knee. Like, as in, he is buggered. And like, you know, they start x-raying bodies and, you know, dislocated elbows and dislocated shoulders and the stitches. Obviously, the Lions in 97, that was all the stuff around Will Greenwood swallowing his tongue and Jono getting stitched up.
People love that.
It's 30 years ago. You know, it's crazy that there's been nothing since. It's mental, but that's our game.
UFC don't paper over it. You know, they don't paper over it. They embrace that, you know, and people love it. So, like I say, I think the game is actually safe. People might think I'm trying to make out it's this heroic, barbaric thing. I actually think the game is pretty safe. When you think that there are hundreds of collisions a game, it actually baffles me there aren't tenfold more injuries, you know. But I think people should take confidence in the fitness, the medical, that attention that is around the game now, you know. So I don't want people to be scared of the game, but I think that's why I agree with you, 6 out of 10 for Netflix. There's 4 out of 10, which are those small snippets we've spoken about, which if they were shown alongside the training regimes, then I'd be like, now you're showing people what international rugby is all about, you know, and then people would understand more when someone like an Owen Farrell decides to step away. They go, all right, yeah, we know, we've got a taste of what he's been through. I get it, you know. So I think that's the bit they don't show.
Yeah, well, hopefully that changes for sure. And I agree with you, the game's never been safer. Like, that's what it feels like, all the things that are in place. So I think this next generation, hopefully, reap the rewards with that. The money starts coming back into the game. So I think we're in a good place. Like, the Six Nations, which normally after the World Cup are normally quite poor, aren't they? And I did feel going into the Six Nations, I weren't as excited about it. It was like Wales are in transition, you know, England are all over the place. The emotion of France, which we saw, does it matter if Ireland win the Six Nations again? Do they compare to the World Cup? Is that what they want or not? Actually, on that, Warby, did you get the feeling, like, Peter O'Mahony does his interview after and you see the celebrations? And you can maybe talk about this because you've been there, you've won Grand Slams, you've won things before. For Ireland, it was the World Cup, right? The Six Nations, them winning that just felt like it was all right. But you could see there was something, right? There was something missing. Did you feel that?
I think so. It did feel like, you know, like when you open a birthday present you didn't want? It almost was like, it was almost like that. Of course, there's going to be some elation, some happiness. Of course, just won a Six Nations, very hard to do. And look, I was never part of a team as good as the Irish team. I was part of a good Wales team. We weren't as good as Ireland. You would be gutted. You would be absolutely gutted. But fair play to them for fronting round and coming back to win the Six Nations. But yeah, I think it was that. It's all about the World Cup. You know, mate, there's people who've won the Six Nations every year. Don't get me wrong, it's an amazing thing to do. But mate, if you win a World Cup, your team and name is going to be set in stone in history. So to miss out on that is so gutting and so deflating. I did feel that with Ireland on the weekend as well.
I wish Pete said it though. Do you know what I mean? I wish he was honest.
I know. Do you know, that's what I've said to like a couple of the young Wales captains. I'm like, I think what people want from their captain in post-matches, as long as you're really honest, I think people really resonate with it. If you win, don't play it cool. Be elated, because everyone else at home, all of your other countrymen and women are elated. If you're gutted, be gutted and show you're gutted. It's okay to be gutted on a loss. There's like, you know, if somebody gets like a cap or they get a 50th cap and they're like, oh no, it's all about the next one. I'm like, no, it's not. You're a 50 captain. Like, it's amazing. All your family are here in the box. You can't wait to see them. You're going to hug them all after. Like, just be honest. Just be honest with people. So yeah, I think that would be my number one advice for any young captain. Obviously, you can't give everything. But if you can be more often than not just genuine and honest, I think people resonate with that. And that's when I think you get the captains who people.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Really like is because they can just relate to them. You've got to be relatable. I think that's the best way.
Right, we're talking of being honest. I know you've done it in a few different forums and it kind of blew up on social media around like investment in Wales.
I had no clue it would. I was just spitballing. I was like, oh shit, what have I said now?
I know. But it's great, mate. And it's topical and it then triggers conversation. It really does. And they're important conversations because in Scotland, no one until I did the podcast last night is really talking about the state of the game here. Like the under-20s playing in the Six Nations was dangerous. Compared to the athletes they were up against playing against France and Ireland. It was dangerous. You know what I mean? As in the comparison between athletes, you've got lads that are playing in France, 200 odd top 14 caps in the France under 20s. You've got the Scotland under 20s. They're not even semi-professional. Like, it's dangerous. You know, Menoncello's 21. Daffy Jenkins is 21. They're playing men's rugby. Like, these lads are meant to step up and do it. So the conversations that need to happen, the conversations around investment. So the question is, just give us a lay of the land. What is the state of rugby like in Wales? Is it fucked at the minute? Is there a way out?
So the easy excuse, because everyone naturally goes to the governing body, which is the Welsh Rugby Union. And look, the higher you are in any walk of life, the bigger the dartboard on your back. And that's just something you've got to accept, whether you're a player, whether you're a governing body, whether you're a CEO. You just got to take the rough with the smooth. And that's why I feel for the governing bodies and the Welsh Rugby Union, because everybody just naturally, something goes wrong, bang, you all look to the Welsh Rugby Union. But I think maybe naive people might say, oh, you got to invest in grassroots. And I'm like, really? What, investing in just in 4 or 5 year olds now is going to change the game? I'm like, no, like you can try and encourage me to do something. But if I'm not seeing something aspirational at the very top, I'm going to be like, well, what's the point? You know, why am I going to bother with this? I'm like, you need to, I don't say you neglect grassroots. There should always be a proportion of your turnover which goes to grassroots or goes to community projects. Say like, I'm on the board at Cardiff Rugby now. Mate, we got a lady called Nadine. There's a phenomenal job at community level. But say our budget, or say our annual turnover is 13 million quid. Well, guess what? A massive proportion of that goes on the first team and the staff and the facilities. Because if that's not functioning, you can go to as many schools as you want. They ain't going to care. If there's no product to look up to, they're not going to care. So we factor in the community level, and they get in touch and engage with hundreds of thousands of kids. They do an amazing job. So you can still do that, and it's vitally important. But the majority of the spend is on the team, the first team and the academy and the pathways. So that's why I think with the Welsh rugby, I'm like, if you've got a successful national team and you've got successful regions, guess what? All the youngsters watching this are going to think this is a pretty sexy sport to play, and I want to be that next icon and role model. That's going to be me. And that's what inspired me when I was growing up. You know, there was good Cardiff teams when Cardiff were in the European Cup final, late 90s. Wales won a Grand Slam in 05. And I was like, I want to be that guy. You know, like, if you haven't got that success, your pyramid, the bottom of your pyramid is going to get much smaller. So when people think it goes bottom up, I think, actually, no, you reverse it. It comes top down. And the analogy I said was, if you asked any, like, pro sport, NFL team or Premiership football team, right, your turnover and your budget, where do you spend most of your money? They don't go, oh, yeah, we throw it all away to, like, community and grassroots. Like, I'll reiterate, which is important. No, it goes on the first team, because if we ain't in the Premiership, no one's going to care about us. So I always think you've got to invest in your professional game first and foremost. And say, look at England in 03. When they won the World Cup, I bet you, because they won the World Cup, engagement in rugby clubs around the country would have been flying, and interest would be flying, because all the kids are thinking, I bet how many kids were probably cupping their hands, kicking goals in their local parks because they wanted to be Johnny Wilkinson. You know, like, you got to build these stars, build these iconic teams, and then naturally the interest will follow. So I think, yeah, I think people might just think, oh, you got to work from the bottom of the pyramid. I disagree. You work top up. And I've only got a small business now, but what's the one thing you have to focus on? The product. If the product's not good, people ain't going to buy it. So you've got to focus on the product. And in rugby, that's your professional game.
Yeah, no one buys into nice either, do they? They buy into success. They buy into winners, especially in sport. And that's what people in rugby, the frustration I've had is, it's entertainment. If you're not an entertaining product and you don't shout about it, and the tone of voice, the narrative, the storytelling around it, there's no interest, is there? There isn't that interest in it. And in order to get that, you have to have, like you've said, something to look up to. That's why, imagine if Ireland won the World Cup, and I know they've got it right in Ireland already, but it comes down to investment. You look at South Africa, what's coming through. South Africa are going to be fine forever because they invest in their youth. You look at the schools ripping. Yeah, some of it's a bit loose, some of it's illegal in what they do, when you hear some of the stories coming out of Craven Week. But that's because the size of the prize is so big that they're willing to take risks and do anything possible to be a Springbok, because the incentive is so large. The same in Ireland now, Warps. You look at the opportunities at Leinster, Munster, to be an Irish international, the kind of brand that it's now built. The All Blacks are exactly the same. But that comes down to, like, the investment in the academies as well. We know we're close to the game. The investment that goes into the Leinster school system, the Munster academy system, it's money. Like, these coaches are paid six-figure sums. They're not just a level four coach and, oh, yeah, they're decent, we'll get them in. We'll just get them in. They're a level four coach. They're the best of the best, because our game is so technical. It requires the best athletes possible, so strength and conditioning, nutrition. And that starts so young now. It's 13, 14. They need to profile players at that age, kids at that age, to be like, look, you're 6'6". So already aesthetically, you've got an opportunity to be a second row. We don't build 6'6" people in Wales or in Scotland. So we've got a framework to now build in at the age of 14. Let's put you in an academy. Let's invest in you. You might come good. You might wreck your knee, and that'll be the risk that we take. But nutrition, training, gymnastics, judo, hand-eye coordination. Let's get you indoors in the gym doing catch pass, catch pass, catch pass, catch pass. So actually, when you're 16, 17, we're like, we've molded you into being an Ebenezer Beth, a Peter Steph De Toy, an Alan Wynne Jones, a Maru Itoje. And people don't like talking about it, Warbs. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, we haven't got any money. We're not going to invest. There's money in the game. You see where they put it into different pockets. It's just how they choose to spend it.
Mate, that's why, like, it's not a plug, right? But that's why my online academy, our strapline is we build athletes. You can't just rock up and play rugby. You have to have a certain level of physical resilience. If you're not doing your due diligence, as you've just said, from under 14s level, we've even spoke about, we'll run our own combines and we'll profile people and then we'll showcase what progression people can make and how they can develop into an athlete. And like when you're looking at the school systems, like Welsh rugby used to be, their academy used to be governed by the Welsh Rugby Union. Mate, when I was playing 20s rugby, regularly our 20s sides were making semi-finals of World Cups, competitive in Six Nations. No one in my, we had one player in my 20s team, I remember, who was playing in Bristol. And that's because he was an exile. I mean, everyone was at home because the incentive was to be in a national academy in Wales where you're really well looked after, you're financially rewarded, supplements looked after, training regimes are brilliant, great like feedback and skill sessions on analysis. Like, you know, I was like, I'm living like, turning pro was easy for me because I felt like I lived like a pro from the age of 15. They sat me down with a nutritionist at the age of 15. This is going back 20 years now. I thought Cardiff were excellent, the academy system and the manager we had there. But it was essentially governed by the Welsh Rugby Union. So no one slipped at the fishnet. But then they went to the regions. Now, I wonder whether because regions have been underfunded and haven't generated themselves enough money, whether there's been a slight neglect potentially. Because otherwise, why else would all these, there'd be a mass exodus of 16 to 18 year olds playing in England? I don't blame them, by the way, because the schooling system over there and the care and attention they can get is great. So I'm like, well, for example, if it's in Wales, I'm sure these conversations are happening. Jamie Roberts is now a non-exec director at WIU and he's an intelligent man. So I'm sure he'll contribute to there brilliantly. And the new CEO would have done their due diligence, Abby Turney. I'm sure she'll be brilliant. So the, and they're doing strategy, figuring out strategy now. So they can't, it's going to take time to fix these things. But like, every region, I include North Wales in that, so it'd be a fifth region in Wales. You need to have like three or four hub schools, as you say, which have, like maybe they go through an application process and you need to help fund them as well. So they can have the facilities, they can have the coaches from a skills perspective, from an S&C perspective, from a nutrition perspective, alongside studies. So a mixture of colleges and a mixture of high schools for your conventional A-levels. Anyone who's any good goes to one of these hub schools, these licensed WRU regional hub schools, and no one falls out of the fishnet. They're on the radar. And I had this idea, like, I won't take the, it's not my idea. I was chatting to Brian O'Driscoll. I was like, mate, how are Leinster so good? He's like, mate, at like BlackRock, they'll have like amazing coaches for all various things. So there'll be hundreds of kids in the system who've all had this care and attention alongside their studies from the age of 14 all the way up to 18. And then they just bottleneck and bottleneck and bottleneck. And by the time you get to 20s level, you've got like 30 elite athletes almost by the age of 19, 20, because they've gone through a rigorous 6-year process with highly skilled people managing them along the way, all under the radar, all within the radar, sorry. So, and the communication between those schools and the academies and then the first team is regular, so you know exactly where every player is at. Mate, we're small countries, Wales and Scotland. We've got to harness everything we've got to the nth degree. And if I said, has that level of diligence happened over the last 10 years, because the academies now have not been centrally governed, well, why has Cardiff produced Chris Schunzer, Faye Waboso and Lewis Rees-Zammit, all from the Cardiff area? They're not here. They've exited the Cardiff system. So I know Cardiff are, the great thing with Cardiff is they've recognised this and they're making change now, which is great. And I'd like to think that our academy system will be very robust in a few years, but that's got to be across the whole country. So, you neglect something. We're seeing, and a lot of coaches who were involved in the academy system going back 10 years ago, I speak to them now and they say, mate, what we're seeing now is the fruits of the labour of not having a centrally governed academy system. Too many kids have fallen through the fishnet. Underdeveloped people are playing the game at the age of 20 because they haven't followed a 4 or 5 year process. And when you see a good 20-year-old playing international rugby, yes, there are genetic freaks playing our game physically in a complementary sense. You know, athletically, their ceiling is higher than others. But really, it's because those players have had a 4 or 5 year journey where they have done all the mundane, boring things that most teenagers aren't willing to do, which has created them into this elite athlete. It's like it's that Muhammad Ali thing, you know, like, you know, you can, it's what you do behind closed doors, but you eventually you'll get that nugget in 5 years' time. Now, maybe a lot of teenagers aren't willing to go through that long a process, but the ones who are, you will beat 99% of the opposition just by having that level of diligence and preparation. And no, there's no guarantee. There's no guarantees in life that you make it in anything. But if you go through a 4 or 5 year process where you're being physically looked after, nutritionally, your skill set, you know, you do that from the age of 14. When you get to 20, you're going to have a much bigger pool of some pretty freakish rugby players you can pick from. And that's the level of due diligence that I think the smaller nations in particular, from a population perspective, like Scotland and Wales, have to go through. You're just going to end up in the situation that we're in now.
1,000,000%. Is there any light in Wales, Sam?
Do you know what?
Was it a while away?
We'll find out this summer. W are apparently going to be releasing some interesting news over the summer, and they're going to be reviewing their strategy. And it'd be interesting to hear what comes out of that. But even if the right pledges are made now, and for a fan, the reality is the benefits of that are probably going to be seen in 3 to 5 years' time. So there's no... I think a lot of people want to go, well, have we got the right coaching setup, or have we had the right team selection? I'm like, look, it's way deeper than that. It's a long-term process, which is what gets your players to the national team, to the pro club. So it's going to be a long fix. And that's where look at Ireland. They've had an amazing system in place for a long time at that younger level. Just a conveyor belt of players coming through. We're going to have to try and create that, and for that conveyor belt to come to fruition, that's going to take some time.
Yeah. Just lastly, the thing in Ireland, and I might be making it up and talking bollocks, but I kind of confident that this is right. There's investment from government. I know there's investment from government on tax returns for the likes of Brian O'Driscoll and these multi-million pound earners, because they're seen as artists and they get a tax return at the end. But I think there's a buy-in from a government level. They see the value of having a top rugby team globally. And we don't have that in Scotland. I know that for a fact. Like I mentioned, obesity's through the roof. We've got loads of issues in this country. Are government interested in rugby in Wales, or just like coming to the glitz and glamour of the game?
I'm not trying to sound clever. I'm glad you brought that up, because when I knew I was coming on, I was thinking of things. And I thought about the Irish tax incentive. So you might go, what? Well, we can't have that. Money goes to money. I'm thinking, now look at it from an economy perspective. If you've got a successful Wales team, who are doing very well, competitive in the Six Nations every year, there is a massive benefit to the government and economy to have 200,000-300,000 people plough into Cardiff on a match day and spend money. You're talking tens and tens of millions of pounds are being spent. That's got to be a good thing for the economy. So to reward the very few elite players who do stay in Wales, for example, for 10 plus years to get some sort of tax return benefit like they do in the Irish system, is an enormous incentive to stay in the country where we don't have the immediate funds. But surely the benefits the economy to have, and not just the national team, to have successful professional club sides as well, which all bring in revenue and income and adds to the economy. If you actually outweighed that benefit compared to the very small release of a tax return to players who have pledged their whole careers to play in Wales, that you have to have an incentive to stay in Wales for that. I think that's a pretty good trade-off, actually. So I think at government level, I'd like to think that there would be conversations on how they can incentivize players to stay, because you keep all the best players, you're going to have better teams, better pro team, better national team, and there's going to be much more excitement around supporting that national game. And you've been to Cardiff. Cardiff is absolutely bouncing. I would be gutted if we got to the point where Welsh rugby was playing Scotland in the Six Nations. And that, like, years gone by, that's always a sellout. England's always a sellout. If ever those games weren't sellouts, my goodness, we'd be in trouble. So that's why I talk about the product. You know, you have to focus on the product first, because if the interest goes from the top products, then, mate, that's going to be a big uphill climb then.
Especially if Wales are playing Belgium and Portugal as well. Which brings me on to the next, because it's doing the rounds on social media. There's a clip that came out around you saying that relegation, when Italy were awful, and Scotland, it was my generation actually, were poor as well. What are your feelings on the Six Nations promotion relegation? Cockerell, Richard Cockvilly, who is kids after my kids actually, yeah. So he lives down the road. His kids live down the road. So I see them all the time. But he's coaching Georgia now. He's come out and said it's now time. They are too good, aren't they? They've won it how many years in a row? Something ridiculous. Yeah. But it's a conversation that probably needs to be had now. But not because it's Wales who got the wooden spoon. Hopefully it's a one-off for Wales, but it seems like it could be something going forward. But that almost, like you imagine, will be like, if that was to happen now and Georgia, say there's a game that's played in the summer and they say, well, we're going to bring it in and Wales get put into the Europe Challenge B competition and Georgia come up, like you could arguably see that being the end of Wales. Are you for it or against it?
Yeah. So I think with this, it's very... I initially said, yeah, relegation would be great. It's jeopardy. Not direct relegation. It would be like a playoff. If Georgia can come to Wales, for example, this summer and beat Wales, mate, could you imagine how many people would tune into that game? You'd watch
exactly.
it.
Yeah.
You'd watch it. You know, see if Georgia could do a job on us and then get promotion. And I do agree, look, that is very high risk. If you're a home union and there's an option to have the cash cow of the Six Nations with no relegation or have relegation because it's good for the game, of course they're going to choose no relegation because they want the Six Nations. I say it with one kind of... I used to look at it from the development of the game. I didn't say I wanted Italy to go down because I don't like the Italians. But Italy's a great country. I said it because they'd lost 36
they won't win
games
the game.
In a row.
Yeah, of course. That was it. That was the perspective on it. They were losing every game and they were bottom and they were winning every wooden spoon. Yeah, so I get that.
And the message I had then was that Italy weren't utilising that they're equal, because every Six Nations team, they're equal shareholders in the Six Nations. They weren't apparently, from sources, using their money efficiently. They were just kind of getting complacent. Now, I think that's very different now. Now it seems they've got very good structures and systems in place, and we can see that with their 20s coming through. But I just think as a business, right, if you are told... Say like we go in the car industry, you pick any car manufacturer, like, look, you guys are going to be the 6 top sellers in your industry. We're going to ring fence you and no one else will be able to compete with you. Mate, that's going to stop innovation. It's going to stop accountability. They're going to get laziness. And I'm only saying this because I'm seeing it off recent evidence from some home unions. It looks like that we've got complacent. And I do understand what I say might not be the right way, but I just hope that people understand that hopefully... the thought process of how can we better the game, and I'm not saying, look, without relegation, I'm not keen. It would take a few minds, more intelligent than mine as well, to bang heads and go, okay, well, have you considered this? And somebody, I was having a conversation, like, well, to be fair, Sam, I like what you're saying, but, and this is a commercially viable argument, which I completely understand, which makes me think, well, maybe we need to try... Well, what about a Seven Nations? Let's just trial a Seven Nations. You're going to talk about reducing two of the fallow weeks. Just replace one fallow week with Georgia, for example, and let's try a Seven Nations. They said, what would happen if England got relegated? The whole commercial value of the Six Nations would plummet because we all need England because it's the biggest country. And I was like, yeah, good point. And I'll accept that I don't know everything. And that's one thing I learned as a captain. I don't know everything. But the one thing you do need to get is get people in a room who can all contribute to come out with the best conclusion. So am I saying it's my way or the highway? No. It's just an initial suggestion that hopefully that people understand it's coming from a good place. How can we improve rugby globally? And look, and if a team was to go down, is there a way World Rugby can help subsidise them for the short term to help them come back? Or maybe the safest option is the Seven Nations. You know, would I rather South Africa come in or would I rather Georgia come in? I think South Africa is a brilliant rugby playing nation, but there's something about it being a European competition, which, call me old school, I like that. And I love that when South Africa travel up to us and we travel there, that makes it even more exciting. It needs to be a special game when you play South Africa because you don't play them that regular. So I'm not saying it's the only way, but I just think we cannot keep putting a glass roof on some of these second tier nations. If they know they've got an incentive, they can enter in some capacity, shape or form a Six Nations type competition. Surely they're going to go, my goodness, we're going to drive this like crazy as a business. And then it'll make all the other home unions make sure they're doing their due diligence across all aspects of their business as well. So I think it just drives competitiveness, productivity, accountability across the board to help improve our game.
Yeah, 1,000,000%. And also us having these conversations, and we're not always right. They're just opinions based on opinions, and there might be snippets of knowledge, but they spark conversation, right? As in your comments that were brought up from Italy a few years ago, and now Wales won the wooden spoon, have now sparked us to have the conversation and be like, look, we're not 100% right. We don't know. Like, what is the jeopardy of a Georgia coming up and an England going down? Well, you've just mentioned that England are the biggest union, like financially one of the biggest unions in the world. You know, if a Portugal, if there's an opportunity for them to come up, does Ronaldo buy Portugal rugby? And then all of a sudden rugby blows up. But that's what no one's having these conversations. They seem, every time you bring something up, not just you, but as in me or anyone in the media, it feels like it's divisive. Oh, they're saying this like he's an idiot. No. We're talking about things in our game, as in, like, we want to make it more interesting. We want to make it more compelling. We want to see jeopardy. We want to see interest in these spaces.
And this is the thing, like, mate, I'm more than happy to be put down and go, Sam, I like where you're coming from, but it won't work because of this reason. And if they told me why, I'm going to go, good point, fair enough, I take it back. Like I say, these are just things to try and, you're just trying to, like, not be a visionary, but you're just trying to, like, just try and help to make change for the better. People don't like change, naturally. But sometimes, not all the time, you know, if something's not broke, you don't have to fix it. But sometimes I look at things, I think it's broken. I think it's broken. I don't think it's right that Georgia can fill out a 60,000 seat stadium or 50,000, whatever it is, but have no opportunity to even entertain the idea of playing Wales or England. Mate, Tbilisi away from home would be a pretty tough place to play, I think. Place to play in a, never mind, and that would be probably in a friendly, never mind in a potential 6-7 nations, whatever. And look, I'm not saying my way's the only way, but look, right, somebody out there, rather than come back at me and be negative and say, no, what you on about, you haven't got a clue, come about it in a constructive way and go, right, like where you're coming from, what about this? Shall we discuss this option instead? So it's not like a, it's not like I'm having a sword off going, no, it has to be this. It's like, no, look, this is a starting point for further discussion. And it might come up with a different conclusion, but at least it betters the global game. So I think that's just what this hopefully is a catalyst for.
Yeah, 1,000,000%. Warbs, there's loads we can talk about. I'm going to just a couple more things. We've got to go and get the kids on the school run. You mentioned South African teams there. I think we were aligned, and I go based on social media again, about like when Cardiff played in the Champions Cup and who did they play against? Which English club did they play against? Was it?
They played Bath and Quins.
They played Bath and Quins, and they were mega games, right? You saw the energy in the stadium. We're both across the URC. We've played in that tournament. I've played in the Premiership as well. Also the old school days of the Anglo-Welsh leagues where they were combined, such jeopardy, the kind of history, the hatred as well, if you want to go as far deep into that. Do you think that needs to come back? And it's got a two-pronged question. And I say that having been on social media and seeing Hamish Watson get off a flight from Edinburgh to South Africa and his eyes are basically closed. I said, what's wrong with you? You look like you're pissed or you've had allergic reaction. He said, I've been flying for 27 hours. He said, I'm absolutely fucked. My eyes, my head's swollen. So twofold question. Do we want to see an Anglo-Welsh league? Do you think commercially that's better? And how sustainable is it having the South African teams in the URC? It just seems so unsustainable. Not just from carbon emissions and climate change and travel and all that, but just the fucking travel for a seven-day turnaround game.
Do you know what frustrates me? I've said a few things which have split opinion. Because like I said, I just want to be honest. Look, I'm not saying I'm right, but I want to be honest. I've had, and I won't say who they are, I've had people try and meet me to basically shut me up. And then I carry on chatting to them and I realise, I'm like, oh, you're on the board of this competition, which is why you don't want me to shut up because you want to carry on in your role. And I'm thinking, and this is what frustrates me, self-interest and money, I think, gets in the way of correct rugby decisions. Would an Anglo-Welsh league be better than the URC? Yes,
definitely.
Do England need Wales right now? Probably not. The Welsh teams need to be better, and I acknowledge that. So I'd be like, right, okay, if the Welsh regions can be really good and competitive, then I believe we could add to the English league and it would be brilliant. And I witnessed that with Cardiff when Quins and Bath come down. It was brilliant for Cardiff, and I know it was a European game. The URC players don't want to bite the hand that feeds them, mate. As a Cardiff player or anyone who's playing the URC, to travel every year to South Africa and then to Italy twice, separate occasions, then to Scotland twice on separate occasions, then Ireland four times on separate occasions, then you add in a European competition where you could be playing in Ireland or France. Oh, and by the way, you might be an international player who's travelling as well. Mate, That is a brutal amount of travel for a player. And these are things that I don't think people consider.
Mm.
Now, I do feel there's a responsibility. I wouldn't just go, oh, Angler Welsh, because I'm Welsh and it would be brilliant. I have thought that, what would happen to Ireland and Scotland? I don't just want to throw them into the abyss. You know, you've got to try and think what's the best for the game and for everybody, which is why I'm like, oh yeah, I need help on that idea. Do you know what? I would actually like to keep South Africa in Europe though. I think the South Africans have been brilliant in Europe, and I actually love the novelty of playing a South African team. Mate, I brought a shark shirt when I was a kid growing up. South African fans will have a go at me. I had a Natal shark shirt growing up. I went over to South Africa to play at under 15s, loved it. Went to the Natal Sharks shop, bought loads of kit, used to love the shorts, wore them in the gym all the time.
They were awesome back then as well. Yeah, like Mark Andrews, Andre Venter. Butch James was playing back then as well.
Yeah, they had I loved watching Super Rugby. So I love the novelty. And that's why I think Europe is great. It's not overkill. It's not too much. But I loved it when, what happens when the best in Europe collides with the best African teams? I love that concept. I keep them in Europe. I think the South Africans have been brilliant and they're a great team. And they add to the product because they're competitive and it makes a fun away trip. But when you're doing it domestically all the time as well, I think it's overkill. I think it's too much. So that's why I've suggested a change in the league. And yeah, what frustrates me is when people are talking to me, they're meant to be thinking of what's best for the Welsh game. And I'm like, are you telling me you think this is actually the best option for the Welsh game? Because I think it's absolutely not. Mm. You know, I think there's, I talk about people, it's like less is more. Oh, they're like, oh, but I talk about, oh, you're trying to, for example, like clubs could be scrapping to try and sell 3 or 4 more boxes for a season or to try and get a commercial partner and, oh, look what we can do. But at the end of the day, if the product in the league isn't good and people aren't coming to watch it, or more people aren't coming to watch it, which happens just coincidentally when Wales and England, English sides play each other, mate, the sponsorships aren't going to come. If you focus on getting a better product, less is more, but when you do have games, they're humdingers, all the big boys are playing, travelling fans, commercial partners are way more likely to be involved and it'll be an easier sell. So I think similar thing to sort of working backwards there. But again, people don't like change and they don't like being challenged. But I only say these things because I think it's better for the game. But yeah, it would take more minds to get together and think about it. But unfortunately, I think there's too many people who have self-interest which gets in the way. Nothing I say is because I want it Cardiff just to benefit or Wales to benefit. I say it because I want rugby to be a popular global sport which gets millions of people watching it and people love it because it is an awesome sport. So that's why I say it.
Yeah, I call myself, and other people have called me, a problem maker as opposed to problem solver. I'm not smart enough to be a problem solver, but we're talking about it. So, you know, we need to spark the conversations. Martin and I as well, he came on the Big Jim show a while ago. Brilliant, smart guy.
Yeah,
he was amazing. And chatting to Simon Massey-Taylor at the Prem. So I think people are understanding that there are other voices, other opinions that they can interact with. So I think it's a positive that we are talking about it.
I've spoken to Martin and I had a really good conversation with him. And I think, I think he's done a good job with the URC. Have they made it better? Yeah, they've made it significantly better. They've made it much more commercially viable.
Mm.
Hat tip to that. Very, very well done. But if you still said to me, is it the best possible solution? Because that's what I always look at. It's my mentality as a player. I want to be the best possible player that I could be. So I'll try and explore everything I can to be the best possible player. Now, that's what I think now, if you're looking at like a product or a league, what is gold standard? What would be the single best? And why can't we chase that? Why do we have to accept second best? So have they done a good job with the league for what it is? Yeah, they have. They've made it more commercially viable. Is it the best possible solution? That's where I'm like, well, for me, jury's out on that, you know? So, I can't complain with the effort that the people have done in those roles, done a sterling job in those roles, but I'm just talking about, is it the best product? Still disagree with that.
Definitely. Can you imagine the Australian and New Zealand fans and teams, they're screaming out for the South African teams to go back, screaming out. Because you think about how good it was back in the day when the Waratahs, the Brumbies, the Crusaders, well, all of them, can name all of them, when the Natal Sharks, like you mentioned, were unbelievable, the Blue Bulls, like the brands, the franchises around it. So I think we will get to that point. If you're asking my opinion, I think in the next 5 years, I think something will happen. Something is going to happen, but I think something like that might happen. We might see the South Africans go back into the Super League, and there could be like a worldwide super tournament that maybe replaces the Champions Cup. I don't know.
And that's why I think the Champions Cup and having the South Africans is a real cue. Because like, to play, like, I think then you might be, if you're Cardiff then, and say you have a Heineken Cup Champions Cup draw and you don't have a South African team, it's like, oh, never mind. And then the next year you have, oh, boys, we're going to Joburg. Like, you know, oh, amazing. We've got a brilliant away trip playing in Joburg. Like, it makes it much more of a novelty, and it's going back to my less is more kind of thing. And then you'd be really excited to go to South Africa. But I'd be honest, players aren't excited. I'm just saying this as a player. It's nothing in South Africa. It's anywhere that's 11 hours away. It's not, so don't take this personal if you're South African. But once you've already gone to Italy and Ireland, once you've already been on eight away trips, going on a flight for 11 hours in South Africa, I tell you now, is not optimal. It's not optimal. And I don't think people, decision makers, have not been a player and been in those shoes if they're saying it is. Because I tell you now, it's flipping hard.
Yeah, they're hanging.
Traveling.
They are. Yeah. They're hanging. And not just the players, the staff, the support staff, the resources they've got, they're hanging. They are.
And it's not good for the South Africans. I felt so sorry for some of the South Africans coming to play in Europe. They were going back and forth to South Africa like a yo-yo. That's not good for them either. It's not good. So you'll make it much more feasible for them, I believe, as well. So, yeah, anyway, that's just my 50 pence. I'm more than happy to be put down in a constructive way and balanced way. And like I say, hopefully people know it's coming from a good place, because I love all the rugby nations. South Africa, phenomenal rugby nation. Love Italy as a country and growing rugby nation. Like, Georgia, I'd love to see them grow even further. Wales, my home country. It pains me to see them come bottom. I'm not axing them. I'm just trying to do things to help, because I want us all to be good again. So hopefully people understand I say it with rugby first, with no personal vendetta against anybody.
100%. Warbs, let's finish on something positive, because I saw your Six Nations team of the tournament, and I'm going to talk more specifically back row. So we were aligned on two of the players.
Oh, who did you go with?
I went Michele Lamoureux, Ben Earl, and Tommy. I call him Raphael, Tommy Raffle. That's his name, isn't it? I've been calling him Tommy Raphael for years.
No, it's Raffle, right. I believe, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Tommy Raffle. Yeah, and you went Ollie Chesham at six.
Yeah, I love Chesham at six.
Really?
I don't know, but
okay.
Oh, he's got he fits that Courtney Laws mold. And like, man, I just see him, he's so aggressive. You know, we all about the rugby and sort of the dominant nature of rugby. And I said England had to be violent against Ireland. I know we all about back rows, we all get to the back rows. Someone like Martin, for example, epitomizes that.
He's wicked.
Mate, if you can find this clip, it would be great. It was in the second half against Ireland. And you know about the abrasive nature of rugby. This is what I like about it, particularly for a forward. He got in the defensive line, he shot off the line and bang, Tyke Byrne knocked the ball on. And then Martin gets back up on his feet and just slowly walks past Byrne and just looks down on him. Like, don't you dare come down my channel again, you know? And
mate,
I loved it. Nothing against Byrne, not because it was Tyke Byrne. I just loved the mindset of Martin, which is why I loved him at second row. But Chesson brings that at six. And I just love his athleticism, his engine, his ferocity. Great lineup option. He was my six, and I think he could be a converted number six the way England play, because he suits the way England play. But yeah, mate, Ben Earl at number eight, world class. Somebody said to me the other day, is Ben Earl world class? I said, yeah, before the tournament. They said, really? I said, well, have you seen a game where he hasn't had an enormous influence on it? Every game he plays, he has a ridiculous influence. I was doing a Scarlets game about 3 or 4 years ago. At Scarlets, it was a European game, I believe Ospreys were in town, so I was there as a Welsh sort of voice. I can't remember who I was doing commentary with. I was like, is that Ben Earl in the England squad? Because he is unreal. Like, I can just see a level of athleticism. I know for a fact that his power scores in the gym would be amazing. Mate, I can just see genetically he's just gifted. And then lo and behold, he's in the England squad soon after that. Eddie Jones doesn't pick him much, but Borthwick's backed him. Ben Earl at number eight, mate, is world class. He has a huge influence on every game he plays, and should have been in everybody's Six Nations team. I hope he gets to play the tournament. I think he deserves it.
Yeah, I picked him. I coached Ben when he was a kid, 16.
Oh, did you?
Same thing.
See it then?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Yeah.
So him, Marrow. I didn't have Marrow as good as Ben Earl, Max Malins as well. But Ben Earl, I was like, I thought he was going to be a centre, because he was, it was a few years ago. So it was like your back rows weren't that small. It was like taller, rangier.
Yeah.
And then you had, like, no one was talking about that kind of kneel back size. And he's, I'd say he's probably about the same size, but athlete, power, just as in just the way that he moved, his balance, how receptive he was, like for little things, if you know, he made a tackle, how he got back up off the floor with one hand and back into the line, I was just like, gifted.
Well, mate, this is the thing. Power trumps size in rugby, and I think it's a bit of a misconception. Like, yeah, size helps, but if you've got somebody who is 110 kilo, say 115 kilo, but a bit sluggish, or you've got someone like Ben Earl, who's probably 103, I'm guessing 104, but is explosive as hell, mate, 104 wins every time. Mm. And that's why Ben Earl can play number eight, because he's powerful. So yeah, power, size helps. Obviously, power and size is ideal, but yeah, power does generally tend to trump size. That's why Ben Earl can play number eight, extremely explosive, and he's been quality.
Yeah, I think we went Joe McCarthy and George Martin second row, so I think we were aligned on them positions as well. Yeah I agree on George Martin and Joe McCarthy. But just one for the fans, Wars, before we go. Who's the best back row in the world? So it's one of the greatest of all times in that position. Who is the one, the number one in the world right now?
Oh, so currently playing?
Just currently playing. So if you could choose one, you'd be like, here's my back row.
Yeah, if I was a director of rugby and I could sign one back row player, I would sign Ardie Surveyor still. Ardie Surveyor is amazing. I love his relentless fight to scrap for an extra inch when he's carrying. His work, there's not most back rowers, the advice I give is you've got to be a master at something. A young player asks me for advice. You've got to be X factor at breakdown, or you're a line out athlete, or tackling is your thing, or you're a ball carrier. I look at Ardie Surveyor, I'm like, he is X factor at pretty much all those things, which is why he's World Player of the Year, or has been World Player of the Year. So yeah, best back row in the world right now, I think Ardie Surveyor is a brilliant player, and I absolutely love watching him play.
Yeah, it's weird that, because a lot of people would say Ardie Surveyor as well. Mate, I'm Peter Steph-Tatoy. I don't know whether because he's so big and tall. But do you know what I mean? I don't know what I'm just drawn to that. I'm drawn to South Africa. I love the All Blacks. I love the brand. When Ardie carries and the growling and that kind, you know, the hacker, and just looks cool as fuck. But there's something that draws me towards the South African specimens like RG Snyman, Ebenezer Beth, Peter Steph-Tatoy, like Jasper Visas. I don't know what it is. Maybe that's like there's something like a very lesser version of me in them, or them in me. Like, as in, like, that's how, if I could have my time again, I would love to be like a Peter Steph-Tatoy, like of that Bacchus Botha style mold.
Mate, I can't argue with that. And you know, the game sort of went in around 2015, it went the dual open side thing. So it was going Sam Kane and Surveyor. It was like myself and Tipperick. It was Hooper and Pocock at Australia. It was John Barkley and Watson at Scotland. Do you know what I mean? Like, it very much went down the dual open side kind of thing. And what I loved about that, the 2019 World Cup win for South Africa, is like everyone thought that's the way back rows were going. Oh, the game is fast and it needs to be more skilled. You need two sevens. That's when, like, and I've always said you need a hitter in your team. You need the hitter. You need the enforcer. That's when Peter Steph-Tatoy as a six was like, hold my beer. And he was just this enforcer battering ram, which is what you need, right, at test level. That's what Dan Lydiot did for Wales so expertly for years. You need that in your team, and that's what Peter Steph-Tatoy did. So yeah, I said Ardie Surveyor. You said that straight away, because I was like, oh yeah, I watched him in the recent final and he did the same again. I was like, not many players can deliver performances like that. So he is a special six, I'll give him that.
Yeah, no, he is. I'm heading to Japan actually, end of April, to spend some time with Peter Steph-Tatoy. We're trying to get Ardie Surveyor as well. But right, Richie Mwanga.
What are you doing there?
Just a couple of walk and talk interviews. I say a couple, five or six. Oh,
for the gym show.
Yeah,
oh,
so like the slow walk and talk. So I did one with Dricus du Plessis when I was in South Africa, the UFC fighter. I don't know if you saw it, but that's kind of triggered to like Andre Pollard and Tia Khaleesi. We've got a big audience in South Africa. Oh, so mate,
great idea.
Yeah, so getting Peter Steph-Tatoy would be wicked, because you never see him anywhere, do you?
Sure, and I'd love to hear his mindset. I'd love to hear what he's like as a person. That would be gold dust, mate. So look forward to that.
Well, I'll send it you on. The great Sam Warburton, mate, that was awesome. We could have done 3 or 4 hours. So we'll go and get the kids now back to a bit of reality. But absolutely loved it, mate.
Back to the real world. No, nice one, Jim. Love what you're doing. And thanks for asking me on. Been a pleasure.
Thanks, mate.
You see the dragon? You see the fucking dragon?
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.